this is the day of the big game. And this is the moment of the crucial play, the play that means victory or defeat. And you are the receiver of the long, long forward pass that somehow gets off in spite of the opposition swarming all over the quarterback. And it's a good pass. You have the ball. And now there's only one man that could stop you. And somehow you twist sideways and elude the tackle. And the field is clear, clear all the way ahead. And you're vaguely conscious of white chalk lines passing underfoot as you carry the ball down the field and across the goal line for a touchdown. That kick for a point, it's made, and now the game is over. And all the way to the locker room, success and victory are sweet to the taste. In the locker room, you experience the warm feeling of closeness and camaraderie that comes when men who have done things together are together. There's a renewal of the feeling of self-realization and accomplishment, of being a peer among your fellows, like having a seat at the round table of the knights of old and sitting there legitimately. You've earned your place and have won your letter. You've arrived. Later, as you're leaving, having showered and changed, the coach taps you on the shoulder and says, "Pete, could you spare a minute? There's something I'd like to show you." And of course you say yes. And off you go in the twilight together, walking slowly back toward the playing field. By the time you're crossing the field, it's gotten quite dark. And finally you're standing on the goal line, just a few yards away from the spot where you made the winning touchdown. You turn to the coach with a question. "What was it you wanted to show me?" "Just a minute," he replies. "I've got to get the lights on." He's bending over a small hatch that's countersunk in the turf, working at the fastening. Finally gets it open, reaches inside and throws a switch. Floodlights go on. And suddenly you perceive that the goal line that you crossed for the touchdown is actually the goal line of another playing field, a field that stretches on and on, clear out of sight. You turn to the coach. "Gosh, how big a field is it?" He replies, "It's a 10,000-yard field. I thought you'd like to see it after today." And you ask, "Do I have to play this field now?" "No," he replies, "not until you're ready to. You'll probably want to stay with the 100-yard field that you're used to, at least for a while. Besides, I'd like to have you help me as an assistant next year while you're doing graduate work. You can help me get the boys in shape. But whenever you do feel like it, there's a big field to play on." And so for a while you enjoy being an old boy. You're a graduate student. And most of your time is spent teaching your juniors and helping the coach with the team. Until there comes a day when you get to thinking about that 10,000-yard field. It's been most pleasurable being an old boy, being an assistant coach. But what would it be like to try out for a team that played on a field like that? A field 100 times as large as the old one. What would it be like? Curiosity is the everlasting despoiler of contentment. The urge of adventure will always win in the long run. And so there comes that day when you have a little talk with the coach and say goodbye to the undergraduates. Have a farewell dinner, and move on to try out for the team that plays on the big field. It takes much longer to make this team, ever so much longer. But you are the persevering type, and eventually you do make the first team. And in enough time, history will repeat itself. And this very thought flashes through your mind as you're running down the field to receive one of the longest passes ever attempted. And it comes off clean, and you have the ball, and there's no one ahead. And you pound down the field, white chalk line after white chalk line, passing underfoot, and it's over. It's a touchdown. After the game, back in the locker room, you have the same good feeling of belonging and of accomplishment, and of having measured up to a challenge. The same good feeling of being a part of the team, of being a part of something bigger than you are, and of being worthy to be there, and of having earned it all, fair and square. Just as you're leaving the locker room, you have an odd feeling of having been here before. It's a feeling as though something old and familiar were about to happen. And you experience a sensation almost like the release of tension when the coach strikes step with you and says, "Pete, there's something I'd like to show you." You walk along in silence together for a few moments until it becomes apparent that you're retracing your steps back to the playing field. Then you stop and turn to the coach and say, "This one's a million yards, isn't it?" And the coach replies, yes, but how did you know? I don't know how to deal with infinity, but I think that little tale helps a little, get a feeling for it. I was trying to explain this thing to my son and his girlfriend, and that whole story got, I don't know, it just kind of got put together that night. Charlie told me, he said, gee, Pop, he said, that's good, why don't you put it in the story? I said, will do. And that's the kind of things I'm looking for. Do you get a feeling from it? Because you know this isn't the last playing field, even one that's a millionaire. And by now you can figure a proportion. The next one's 100 million.
I wish he'd have had some people trying to block that pass.
You know, I did.
Mary Catherine wishes he took a shot.
Instead of, I knew that, you know, they could get the pass off of him. The quarterback wasn't going to have the trouble he was going to have, would he?
What's that?
Well, you know that the powers to be could get the pass off. The quarterback wasn't going to have any trouble, but, oh, I tell you, I wish they'd have sure been
over that.
Trying to block
that.
Well,
you'd like to have seen that 10,000-yard pass.
That's what I was talking about.
We tried
to send him back to
the
shower room, but it wasn't sending back to the shower room at all. It was a little off
position.
Sure, you know he had some trouble,
catching.
Well, he had some experience.
How long do you think you've had that football story in your mind now?
I don't know.
Well over a year.
I just worked it out last. I worked it out during Christmas holidays when Charlie was home from school.
Oh, yeah. I thought maybe it's been incomplete.
Well, I don't know where it's been. I just know where it came out. Let me read you a little bit from our conclusion. We've completed our study of the Master Universe. It's been a long journey in concept since we first considered the dawn of time, the beginning of the second universe age. We traced the development of the Master Creation from the first creative thesis of perfection, Avona, in relation to the imperfect super universes, on through the finite story, with the emergence of the Supreme Being and the perfecting of the super universe. We've explored the whole of the Absonite story, starting out with the second creative thesis, the grand universe in relation to the outer space creation, and have followed it to the final emergence of the ultimate and the completion of the vast master creation. We have twice seen the completion of the cycle of thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, and have observed the beginning but not the ending of the third cycle. We have come a very long way, and our study proper has drawn to its logical conclusion. The purpose of the Master Universe. The very first paragraph in the introduction to this study consisted of several questions. We would do well to repeat them here. Actually, what is the Master Universe? Do we really have much of an understanding of what the papers mean when they speak of it? Do we have any proper understanding of how God's purposes are unfolding in the Master Creation? Do we have an appreciation of the purpose of the Master Universe itself? At the conclusion of our study proper, we should have arrived at some fairly valid answers to these questions, at least valid from the human perspective. We have learned something about what the Master Universe is in terms of physical size, and we have estimated the duration of the universe ages in terms of time. But concerning God's purposes in the Master Creation and the purpose of the Master Universe itself, we have probably done little more than scratch the surface of the whole concept. Nevertheless, we have, rightly or wrongly, developed certain concepts of the whole Master Creation and the reasons for its existence, and God's purposes that are unfolding in it. We submit that the master creation is the arena of God's adventure into the realms of relative reality, sub-absolute reality, finite and absonite reality. In the master creation, God is adventuring, and a part of his adventure is to see if he can win the allegiance of creatures such as us by the compelling power of love alone. One who once spoke for God once said, "He who would save his life will lose it." So there is likely to be little merit in working out a plan for bargaining with God in terms of constructive morality or good works or planned survival. But to respond to the challenge of love, the challenge to partake of divine perfection, this could lead us out into the immediate adventure of the paradise ascent, and thence to the eternal adventure of exploring the infinity of God and the infinity of God's love. God projected himself existentially in past eternity. The master universe appears to be the base, the foundation, from which he seems to intend to project himself experientially in future eternity. From a creature's viewpoint, the master universe is our larger home. It is the place where we are born, grow, decide, ascend, find God, complete finite destiny, and go on to absonite levels of growth and achievement. When we have attained absonite destiny, we will probably have come of age. Then we will likely be mature citizens of the master creation. We will have attained a status which should qualify us to participate in the final experiential adventure, the eternal adventure, the quest for the Father as absolute. From the larger perspective, the entire Master Universe career is one of preparation for the absolute adventure. And someday, we shall look back on all of this and know in fact what we now visualize in faith. The Master Universe is the spawning ground of the children of experience who will someday participate in the establishment of the unending universe of infinity. From the perspective of deity, the master universe appears to have four purposes: the evolution of the two experiential trinities and the emergence of the two experiential deities. Without the two experiential trinities, there could be no organization of the Trinity of Trinities. And without the two experiential deities, there could be no formation of the two experiential trinities. The deity function of the master creation is the generation of the Supreme Being and the Trinity Ultimate, and the emergence of God the Ultimate and the Trinity Absolute. And then we go on to discuss the questions we asked in the introduction. Would they be worth reading again, do you suppose?
I think so.
All right. Section 2, the answers to 7 questions. In the introduction to this study, we asked 7 questions about the Master Universe. At the conclusion to this study, it is fitting to see how we have fared in working out the answers to these questions. So, let us repeat these questions as they were originally asked, and then take inventory of the answers as this study has worked them out. Question 1. How large is the space level? Do they compare in size? We have determined that space levels vary greatly in size. The grand universe is comparatively small in comparison with the outer universes. The space levels increase in size as we move outward from the super universes to the 4th outer space level. This increase in size is very great. Question two. How long a time is a universe age? Are some ages longer than others? We have found out that a universe age is quite a long time. We have estimated the second age, the one in which we are now living, to be 50,000 times as long as the age of the nebula that gave origin to our sun. And this nebula is nearly a trillion years old. It also appears that the outer space ages will be of much longer duration than the present age. Very much longer. We have also seen that all universe ages are not qualitatively alike. The first age is unique. It is a past eternal age. The second age is also unique. It is the age of the growth of the Supreme Being. The four ages of the outer space levels can be grouped together because they are qualitatively akin. They are post-supreme ages, after the growth of the Supreme. They are the ages of the growth of the ultimate. We have projected a final age, a post-ultimate age that is also unique.
It is a future eternal age. It is unending.
Question three. How are the evolutions of the experiential deities and the experiential trinities related to the space levels and to the universe ages? We have discovered that there seems to be a close relationship between these developments. All universes are not alike. Some are nuclear universes, others are cytoplasmic universes.
Remember, in an egg, the yellow is the nucleus and the white is the cytoplasm.
We have identified three successive nuclear universes. A, the central universe is the nucleus of the super universes. B, the grand universe is the nucleus of the outer universes. C, the master universe is the nucleus of the cosmos infinite. A nuclear universe is associated with the appearance of new deity and new trinity. Existential deity and trinity in relation to the existential central universe. Experiential deity and trinity in relation to the experiential grand universe and master universe. A nuclear universe functions as a nucleus in relation to the cytoplasmic universes that are external to it and are dependent on it. Question four. What themes, principles, and patterns can we discover? We found many of these. Let us list them below, after the inventory of these answers to the questions in the introduction. 5. How is man as a finaliter related to all this? We've observed that the finaliters have the capacity to go on and on, all the way through all projected post-Avona growth. Supreme growth, post-supreme growth, and even post-ultimate growth. It appears that the finaliters have the basic personality and the needed attributes that will enable them to continue on forever. They will never encounter absolute or final limits to growth. They may never be able to attain an infinite goal, but neither will they ever be stalemated or frustrated in their endless progression toward that goal. 6. Is the Master Universe the final creation? We have reasonably established that the Master Universe is not the final creation. It appears to be the third and perhaps final nuclear universe. It must exist as the nucleus of something greater, of some greater cytoplasmic creation that will be external to it. 7. What are the final limits? What is the final goal? We cannot find the answers to these questions in our study of the Master Universe, but we do know that the final limits and the final goal are external to the vast Master Creation. These were the questions that we asked ourselves at the start of this study. These are the answers that we have worked out. Then we get into themes and principles that we uncovered. So far, we seem to have identified 9 of them. Would they like to hear those, you suppose, or not? They get kind of technical. unable to work out an answer to the seventh question, final limits and final goals within the confines of this study. Still, we have worked out a number of answers to the fourth question. What themes, principles, and patterns can we discover? There are a number of themes, principles, and patterns that seem to run through the creative design of the Master Universe. Let us take an inventory of our findings. 1. Thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. This principle seems to run all through the antecedents to the Master Universe and its entire history. An original proposition is made. Then it is contrasted by the formulation of a stimulative anti-proposition. And then the two are unified to the benefit of both. 2. The transformation of synthesis. We have observed that a major synthesis of a thesis and an antithesis is signalized by the emergence of new deity. This is the expression of the synthesis. The emergence of such deity then sets in motion a chain of events that results in the formation of a new trinity. This new trinity is the new thesis, the new challenge that arises out of the transformation of the old synthesis. Example, Havon is perfect, the superuniverses are imperfect. When the superuniverses are perfected and they're synthesized with Havona as, you know, under one administration, you have the emergence of God the Supreme. When God the Supreme emerges, this is a synthesis, a major synthesis. When he emerges, a new trinity forms, the first experiential trinity. And this is the transformation of an old synthesis into a new thesis, a new challenge. Number three, nuclear and cytoplasmic universes. All universes are not alike. Some are nuclear in relation to others, which are cytoplasmic. We have observed that a nuclear universe is associated with the appearance of new deity and new trinity, and that such a universe sustains a nuclear relationship to one or more space levels that are external to it. Havona is the first nucleus in relation to the cytoplasmic superuniverses. The grand universe is the second nucleus in relation to the cytoplasmic outer universes. The master universe is the third nucleus, the final nucleus, in relation to the cytoplasmic cosmos infinite. 4. Cytoplasmic need expands nuclear function. Each new cytoplasmic creation suffers from the lack of something that is or was present in its nuclear universe. The superuniverses lack Havona perfection. The outer universes will lack finite experience. This cytoplasmic need challenges the nuclear creation to expand in service ministry and to rise above the growth limit that had been previously reached. In the present universe age, Havona adds evolutionary growth to the static condition of eternal and divine perfection. In the next universe age, the superuniverses will add some unknown growth potential to the present evolutionary growth limit that is represented by established status in light and life. What the cosmos infinite might add to the nuclear master universe could be the opening up of co-absolute growth potential to the creature creation that had completely exhausted all possibilities for finite and for absentite growth. 5. Power personality unification. All experiential growth seems to involve the union of power and personality. This is true on the deity levels of the supreme and the ultimate. It is also true on creature levels and in human experience. On creature levels, the successful unification of power and personality seems to depend on the subordination of matter-dominating mind to spirit direction by virtue of the free will choice of the personal creature. On deity levels, the union of power and personality seems to require the consolidation of all things, meanings, and values, all matter, mind, and spirit reality of the level concerned, be it finite, absonite, or absolute. 6. Creative associations of dual deity. We have observed that dual deity partnerships function on the creative frontier, that Trinity administration takes over after universes have been organized and perfected. We have also observed the transition in the dual deity associations from the Father-Son in the first age to the Son-Spirit in the second and to the Spirit Supreme in the ages of the outer space creations. We have noted that this evolution of these dual associations apparently goes on to supreme ultimate and beyond, but we cannot trace these dual relationships beyond the Spirit Supreme within the confines of our study of the Master Universe. 7. Divergence and convergence. The diversification of reality seems to be favored because it is a technique of avoiding the monotony of sameness. On the deity level, this is shown by the uniquely different natures of the seven master spirits. These spirits personalize seven unique expressions of the unity of paradise deity. These divergent expressions converge finitely in the supreme, absonitely in the ultimate. In terms of the universes, this is illustrated by the uniqueness of each superuniverse, each one being uniquely different from all others because each is reflective of the unique nature of its supervising master spirit. This uniqueness is fostered until the consolidation of the superuniverses after the full emergence of the supreme, and then there is a convergence and a consolidation of the seven cultures. On the planetary level, each of the evolutionary races is encouraged to develop its own culture, and eventually all are blended in the Adamic civilization. This divergence may grow in complexity in the outer space creations. There are seven diverse environments in the superuniverses. There may be 49 in the primary space level, and still more in the succeeding space level. 8. Organic consistency. The universe is a living organism, and it exhibits qualities of organic consistency. Certain actions give rise to certain repercussions that are inherent in the acts themselves. This appears to be true because the universes function in many ways like living organisms. Omnipotence does not mean that the non-doable can be done. The acts of God are consistent, and the functions of his coordinates are likewise consistent. A good example of that, I think, is this. God never creates brotherhood. He just becomes the father of each creature. And you can't have that without having brotherhood, can you? Brotherhood is an inescapable corollary of God's fatherhood. 9. Trinitization as an escape from infinity. We did not actually derive this principle from our study of the Master Universe. It is pre-Master Universe, and perhaps post-Master Universe. At the end of this study, we encountered the barrier of infinity and the impasse of the absolutes. This produced a stalemate in the efforts to unify on the part of the second experiential trinity. In the prologue to our study, we observed that God escaped from the limitations inherent in his infinity by the technique of trinitization. In the epilogue, we will encounter a similar situation, but with a difference. God is breaking out of infinity. The experiential deities are trying to break in. We submit that this has been a profitable study. When we get into the epilogue, it gets a little complicated if you haven't read what goes before. But I remember when I first drafted the second epilogue, I still got the first draft. This is the second here, revised. I could produce a page and a half. Now we have 18 pages. I think the third epilogue you might enjoy, because when you get far enough away, it gets simple again, you know. The third epilogue is entitled After the Ending of Endings. In one place in the papers, it speaks of all reality as being symbolized by a great ellipse. It starts out from an infinite and absolute source, and ever seeks a destiny that is equally infinite and absolute. In the first prologue to this study, we sought to understand this source. Now in the last epilogue, we find ourselves again seeking after the same source, only now we use another name, destiny. In the beginning and at the ending, we are searching for the source destiny of reality. This must be the infinite, that being who is best known to us as God. As we've been attempting to follow the unfolding of God's purposes throughout the ages of the universes, and across the light years of space, we have reached certain conclusions. It appears that He is engaged in the eternal project of revealing Himself and of sharing His nature with all of His sons and sons, even as He bequeathed His absolute nature upon the first son, and then shared the sovereignty of all creation with Him in their spirit and as the Trinity. We have followed the divine expansion of God's creative forces and personalities from the shores of paradise into the uttermost depths of outer space in the never-ending cosmos infinite. And yet, with all of this unimaginable expansion, God has neither increased nor decreased in value. The infinite is unchanged. But the meaning of the infinite, the meaning of God, has been modified, enriched, and enlarged as concerns every single being who took part in the supreme adventure, the ultimate adventure, and the never-ending absolute adventure. When ascending mortals finally attain paradise and find God, they have a finite experience in the comprehension of the Universal Father. As finaliters complete their service in the encircling super-universes, they return to paradise to find still more of the Father. They have grown in the capacity to comprehend. At the end of the second age, when we find the Supreme, then we will have a comprehension experience with the wholeness of deity, with finite deity. All of this should enable us to understand the Father as finite, God as He is knowable to finite creatures. When we embark upon the ultimate adventure, we have embarked upon the quest for the Father as superfinite, the Father as absinite. We have seen what a very long time it will take to complete this quest. But this goal does have a limit, and eternity endures, and sometime this limit will really be attained. We will know, actually know the ultimate. And in this absinite achievement, we will find the capacity to know the Father beyond the finite, to know the Father as ultimate. The final adventure, the absolute adventure, is without end. But nothing shall ever daunt us. Nothing shall ever stop us. We shall never reach a stalemate, a final barrier to progress. We will really find God as absolute, but we will never complete this discovery. This exploration of the infinity of God must be endless. We will find him as absolute, but we can never know him as infinite. God, your Father and my Father, is that phase of the infinite which we perceive in our personalities as an actual experiential reality. But still we know that the infinite is there, that he is real, and that he is before the first source and after the final destiny. And so at the end of time, we will still find truth in the words of the teacher of old. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen. That's the end of the study. Our reach of my evaluation of it. This is the afterword. Do you want to hear more?
Yeah.
In the foreword to this work, we liken the Urantia book to a symphony. And so it is. In this afterword, we would like to compare it to a romance, the story of love and adventure. Time after time in the labor of this work, the writer has been struck with the divine affection on the one hand, and on the other, by the great adventuresomeness that seems to underlie God's purposes as they appear to be revealed in the happenings of the history of the Master Universe and all that goes before and all that follows after. God pours himself out upon creation in such a prodigal manner. He gives so without measure that all may be enriched by these gifts. Such are the fruits of the infinite love that he seems to bear for all creatures. God is so loving, but so unsoft. He who gives so much in love, he is also the one who challenges those whom he loves. He is the creator of problems, in the solution of which his children grow. God is so unchanging, but always the cause of change. Always is he putting the ferment of the new and the challenging into the old and the established. And as the old and the new react to each other, each challenges the other. And as each responds to the challenge of the other, both grow and rise above former limitations. God seems to want all of his children to grow, and he seems to want to be partner with each one in that adventure of growth. He gives his spirit to live within us and to share with us the adventure of exploring his infinity in fact and his infinity of love. In the preparation of this work, the feeling has grown upon the writer that it is a story of romance and adventure, a thrilling tale of challenge and response. And the real hero of this whole story is God. This being is the most exciting personality in the wide-spreading universes. This being is the most interesting and intriguing personality in existence. This being is the author of love, and we believe the real source of the spirit of adventure. When he spoke as a man among men and to men, he said, "Follow me, and if we dare, we may." We've traversed many conceptual kilometers in this study. We've been bold in speculation and courageous in adventuresome thinking. There's a passage in the papers that should comfort us in this regard. The papers instruct us, page 330, paragraph 2, that it is best that we not be told too much, that too much information would deprive the thinking mortals of the next 1,000 years of that stimulus to creative speculation which these partially revealed concepts supply. The writer is painfully aware of the limitations of especially his human mind. We perceive so dimly, we comprehend so slowly, we seem so impervious to the light of truth. The speculations in this study are undoubtedly very prone to error. We are so unlikely to reason through to valid facts. But even here, at the very last, another passage from the papers, page 2096, paragraph 8, offers much by way of comfort. All of man's universe romancing may not be fact, but much, very much, is truth. That's the end of the story. That's a fair sample of the project I wish you'd help me with. I need help. I need, above all things, I need criticism. Where isn't it done well? Where can we improve it? Where wasn't it clear? And as I told the group this morning, the very best possible question is the one that you secretly, in your heart of hearts, are afraid to ask because you think it's stupid. That's the best question of all. Because other people are going to have it. And have it. Of the Master Universe, subtitled First Commentary on the Arrangible. That's a kind of an innocent sounding title, you know. Flip that top page over, Bill, that's just a guide to the tabs. And, yeah, there you've got it.
What is that?
The first page?
No,
that's the story proper. The first page? This will be the tail end of that. It just won't go in one binder anymore, that's all. The story proper, I think, will print out. A little under 200 pages. The appendices will run maybe a little under 400. You can flip it over, Bill. I got the whole thing laid out like a book if you want to see it. That's a cheeky dedication, but I feel like it's
a reason. Take off from first.
side pages called The Master Universe I'd bought. I played around with it and got it in third draft. And, oh, let's see, I finished that back in 1956. And there's some copies of it floating around. And then about a year and a half later, I got to thinking, if I took my mathematics out of the story, it wouldn't scare people. And I put it in an appendix, so I started out to rewrite it, take all the complicated parts out, and simplify the story. That was the fourth edition. And I pretty well got that done and decided, well, now I can see a little farther and make it a little nicer, you know, a little more elegant. And I'd just barely gotten into the fifth edition when the structure of this thing hit me, and it hit me pretty much the way it is now. I mean, I've polished it and taken the splinters out of it, but the basic thing was shaped up. So I had to finish the fifth edition, knowing it was obsolete while I was writing it. And about a year and a half ago, I got started on the thing in its present form. And early last year, I got laryngitis real bad, and I couldn't talk for 6 weeks. Well, that's when I got the appendices pretty well drafted. And then I got real sick this last fall, and I had to take 3 months off, and then I deliberately took a fourth month off. That's real hard on income, but you got the thing down on paper, and I wasn't worth a damn working for money until I got this thing written once anyway. I couldn't get my mind off it. It was just like being pregnant, I think. I've never actually been pregnant. But when you're going to have a baby, I'm told that you just don't stop halfway through. I mean, when you go into labor, you just go right on ahead and have it. And I had a kind of that feeling that I was in labor and I had to have it. Well, I think we got a baby here, but I don't think the kid is toilet broken, house broken, or knows how to, you know, wipe his chin. And it's a baby, but it's still kind of uncouth. And I think we if you'll help me, we'll coop it up. It's a damn butt crawling. And walk, doesn't know how to walk yet, so go. The story is the thing I'm worried about. The story is where I need real, real help. And the help I want is criticism. If it's well written, fine, I know it's well written too. But where it isn't well written, that's where I want them to yell like Ed Jones yelled. I was reading the second prologue, and we got to the Trinity, and old Ed says, "Would you mind backing up and going through that once again?" I didn't get it. Well, I made a check in the margin. Now, what was one paragraph is now a full page. And if Ed don't get this, I'll put two pages in there. We'll break it down still finer and still simpler.
Well, that's the thing. You're going to have to bring it down. But this group isn't the one to
criticize. I think it is. Collectively.
Well, I don't know. But the thing of it is, we've been over it.
You'd probably be the most valuable person.
He probably is the most valuable person here because he hasn't been over.
That's right. We'll pay special attention to this gentleman then, will you please?
And he comes up with some goodness every now and then.
Now, in support of the story, I'm giving up a lot in the story. I'm leaving a lot out because you can't tell it all. But I'm trying to keep the minimum essentials in the story. I'll drop out all the secondary things. In the appendices, the support list, I'm writing this not for the casual reader, I'm writing this for a scholar, a student. Somebody that says, well, Let's see now, what do the papers say about how do you bring things into existence? Well, I've got 50 pages typed up there. And I put down everything I can dream of or find in the book. Or what is with this God the Ultimate? Well, I've got about 20 pages written on God the Ultimate. I've pulled together out of the book all the quotations I can find. I've organized them. And I haven't just quote, quote, quote. I've restated them in language that I think is what the book is talking about, so that we have a paper on God the Ultimate. If the book writes a paper, I'm not going to write a paper. But if the book doesn't write a paper, then I'm going to try to write one. There's no paper on the first experiential Trinity, but I got 10 pages in here on it. There's no paper on power personality synthesis, but I got almost 40 pages on that. There's nowhere where they tell chronologically how a local universe comes into existence. Well, there's about 20 pages in here in which I've tried to pull it together and string it together like a story. What's the ultimate beginning of a local universe? Then, of course, I take our local universe, because it's the only one we know much about. And where we don't know, I speculate. I give you my grounds for speculation. How many nebula go into this universe? Well, there's about two ways you can figure an estimate. And so I put down both methods. One way I come out with about 6 or 8, and the other way I come out with 20. And I don't know which it is, you figure. But somewhere in that number is about the number, I think, that are involved, and I don't know which. Or what's with these architects of the master universe and transcendentalers, and what does the word absonite mean? Here's an example. Let's see, that's in God the Ultimate yearbook, isn't it? Burke and I have parallel books, except where I got something in process, and then I have to remember that it isn't the same. So, 18. We would raise an interesting question at this point. Just what are the uses of the word absonite in the papers? As we read these papers, we find them more than one form of the word and more than one usage. Consider the following. It is used to designate the transcendental level of reality as, in the phrase, the absonite level. It is used to denote a super philosophy as, in the statement, neither philosophy nor absonity are able to penetrate. It is used to designate a mental discipline, something that can be studied, as in the usage, on paradise you begin the progressive course in divinity and absonity. It describes a technique of creature origin, as in the stated question, we can describe beings who are personalized, but how could an absonitized being ever be explained? And in describing the master architects, they are spoken of as possessing master minds, superb spirits, and supernal absonites. This must be a quality in a transcendental being that is additive to spirit, just as spirit is something that is other than and more than mind. This question of absonity and absonites is something that also relates to ascending mortals. We are informed that before ascenders leave the local universe, they will achieve full satisfaction of equality of self-realization regarding pursuits of an artistic, intellectual, and social nature. Then they encounter a certain spirit differential that will not be equalized until they have actually finished the pilgrimage through Havona. And then the ascenders will be conscious of a new absonite differential, which will not be equalized until the group has attained the status of seventh stage spirits, and this is ultimate status. These statements strongly suggest that the development of a supernal absonite quality of being is a part of some post-finite evolutionary growth of ascending mortals. A further note concerning the word absonite. In the writer's opinion, this is a coined word, a composite word. It appears to be constructed out of a part of each of two words, absolute and finite. Consider the first syllable of the word absolute and the last syllable of the word finite. If we combine abso and night, we have the word absonite. Now, I think that helps get a feeling for that word. We still haven't really defined it exactly, but we've described it from so many different angles that you have more of a feeling. That's what this is designed to do. Let me borrow that, Willie. I think Gold would get a kick out of it now. These first pages, just for kicks, I set up the way they would look in a printed book. Flip over that very first one. I think it was the index for the tab. So far, we've got 31 appendices projected. I don't know what I'll do if I get 32 because I only got 31 tabs. But I'm not so sure that three of them belong in this study. This nature of each of the absolutes, I've got my notes together and I've got a feeling for how to approach it. But for some reason, I've never even started to write them. I think they belong in another study, which might be called a study of reality. And anyway, this thing is getting so darn long, I'm beginning to think about how thick a book should be, you know. And 500 pages in ordinary paper is going to be almost this thick. See, this is India paper. And I just don't think a book ought to be much thicker than that, or it looks scary. I've got some books in my Cambridge history that run about yay high, and they're real formidable things to pick up off the shelf. I mean, you sort of feel like you've had it when you get one of those in your hand. So I don't know whether this is going to have 31 appendices or 28. I'm inclined to think 28. I'm not going to throw my notes away on the absolutes. We'll write them up someday, but I don't think maybe they belong here.
The architects of the master universe aren't personalities, are they?
I think they're super personalities.
They have absonites.
They sure do. They sure do. Don't ask me too much. I'm just rewriting that appendix right now.
I just thought that when you read that.
They would have to come into being during the zero age before.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I think they're zero age beings.
We can describe beings who are personalized.
No.
But how can
it be before them?
Architects. No. See, they'd have to be there, Bill, before these seven super universes was organized. So we know they were created before that time.
Everybody's architect.
Well, we won't say created, but
eventuated.
Eventuated, yeah.
Bert, let me have that section on eventuation. I think some of them get a kick out of it.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
When I did this appendix first, I just had a little old paragraph about eventuation, which I said, God has a pre-person fragment that a person creates and a super-person eventuates, and the architects are eventuated. Well, I was down visiting Meredith Sprunger. As a matter of fact, he's the fellow that asked some questions that got me thinking about writing this in the first place. He said he was all bugged on create and trinitize. So I did a fair job on those two. But he came back and he said, I do wish you'd write more than one, just this one little short paragraph on Eventuate. Well, I filed his letter under the tab. Someday I'll do this. So my blonde daughter got asking me about Eventuate. And she says, now, Daddy, don't tell me that God is a superperson Eventuates, because first of all, I don't know what a superperson is. I'm not too sure about God. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what Eventuate is. And I kind of blew my stack back at her, and I said, sweetie, if I really understood Eventuate, I'd be super finite. She said, finite schmeinite, write something. So I got to work on it, and you might get a kick out of this, because this would be an example of, this is not an illustration, Burke. This goes in here as a...
Boy,
insert.
Is it? Boy,
insert.
I tell you, I'm really out in left field right this minute. I'm trying.
No.
I'm not.
You're all right. I'll read you this as an example of the opposite of the story. Here's where I'm boring in with everything I've got on the ball to try to figure out something which basically we can't figure out. But maybe we can get to feel more comfortable about it if we talk about it. Eventuation is a term used to designate the manner of the origin of absonite transcendental beings. Page 332, paragraph 38, page 333, paragraphs 1 to 7. These beings have an origin, but the authors of the papers have been forbidden to disclose it. Page 351, paragraph 4. They do tell us, however, that the deity absolute may have been involved in the origin of the transcendentalers and may have something to do with their destiny. Page 350, paragraph 7. We are also informed that the act of eventuation is comparable to the act of creation, in the same sense that God as a superperson is comparable to God as a person. Page 3, paragraphs 17 and 18. Definition of eventuate and event. In discussing the origin of the transcendentalers, the authors of the papers have chosen to use the word eventuate, quote, in order to avoid using a new term, an arbitrary and meaningless designation, end quote, page 350, paragraph 7. Nevertheless, the joint authors of paper 31 must have had some valid reason for choosing this particular word from among all of the words that are available in the English language. It accordingly behooves us to see just what meanings are attached to this word in English usage. Eventuate is in part defined in Webster as an intransitive verb as follows: to come out finally or in conclusion, to come to pass, to be the outcome, to result. As a transitive verb, it is defined to bring to an issue or conclusion, eventuation. This verb eventuate is obviously derived from the root noun event. Let us examine the meanings which are attached to the usages of this noun in English. Event is in part defined in Webster as follows: the fact of taking place or occurring, that which comes, arrives, or happens, that which befalls. In philosophic usage, that which occupies a restricted portion of four-dimensional space-time. In the theory of relativity, a happening represented by a point x, y, z, t in the space-time continuum. Note, this is my own note, the designations of x, y, and z have to do with the description of a specific location in space. They are the Cartesian coordinates of algebra, the equivalent of saying where something is in terms of north, south, east, west, and up, down. The designation T pertains to a specific location, a specific movement in time. These four designations, taken all together, serve to describe a specific location in space at a given moment in time. These definitions give us some idea of the general meanings in English of the verb eventuate and its root noun event. Now, how is the word eventuate used in the papers? Eventuate is used in the papers with the following meanings. Page 332, paragraph 38, and 333, paragraph 1. It designates the origin of beings who are neither creators nor creatures. They are also designated as uncreated non-creators. Page 333, paragraph 7. 350, paragraph 3, and 332, paragraph 38. As a person, God creates. As a superperson, God eventuates. And the beings who are thus eventuated are called Ebsonite superpersonalities and, quote, the eventuated children of divinity, ultimacy, and eternity, unquote. Page 1227, paragraph 7. Relationships exist between two objects, but three or more objects eventuate a system, unquote. What can we learn by comparing the English usages of eventuate with the usages in the papers? From English usage, we deduce that eventuate is something that happens, that takes place, etc. The most nearly similar usage in the papers is in the statement, three or more objects eventuate a system. Such a system is not purposed, designed, manufactured, or created. It just happens. A system is simply and inherently present whenever three or more objects are present within the same frame of reference. That's our three pennies on the table in a triangle. Mm-hmm.
That's your gestalt.
Gestalt, correct. Mm-hmm. Concerning the appearance of such a system, it happens, it befalls, it takes place, it occurs, it comes to pass, it is the outcome, it results. In short, it eventuates whenever three or more objects are together. From the use of the word eventuate in the papers, we deduce that it is a superfinite, absonite action resulting in the origin in quotes, of certain absonite beings. God must eventuate on the ultimate level of reality and in eternity. This is very different from creation on the finite level of reality and in time. With this background of definitions and comparative definitions in mind, we should be able to engage in some speculative reasoning about eventuate. This line of reasoning will be based on one new premise, the principle of consistency. The universe is consistent because God is consistent. First, let us review this principle of consistency as the papers apply it in the form of compossibility in relation to God's attribute of omnipotence. Then we can reason by analogy to see if the same principle might possibly cause the act of eventuation to be related to God's thinking in the formulation of plans. Compossibility as a corollary to God's omnipotence. We are informed that there is a corollary to God's ultimate attribute of omnipotence, and that the name of this corollary is compossibility. Page 229, paragraph 1. Compossibility is defined in Webster as follows: able to coexist with another thing, or to occur or to concur in time and space or in conception, consistent. As omnipotence is associated with com possibility in the papers. It means that God's omnipotent acts create things of nature, and simultaneously, com possibility determines the consistency of the nature of all things that are created. Same reference. To use the same illustration that the papers use to clarify this relationship, let us say that the thing created is a circle. When it is created, the circle is characterized by circularity, and simultaneously, circularity becomes the inalienable nature of all circles. Same reference. A square circle is not, therefore, a creative possibility. It would violate the principle of compossibility, that is, an inseparable corollary of the ultimate attribute of omnipotence. Same reference. The important point to be noted is just this. Omnipotence has attached to it an inalienable corollary that conforms it to universal consistency. The papers express this principle of consistency, page 49, paragraph 5, with regard to omnipotence and omniscience as follows. God's omnipotence does not mean that he can do the non-doable. Neither does his omniscience mean that he can know the unknowable. We have explored this principle of consistency in greater detail in Appendix 15, Section 7, under the caption, The Principle of Organic Consistency. Don't look, you haven't got it yet. We regard this as one of the basic principles that govern the happenings in time and space, in transcended time and space, and in eternity and on paradise. An analogy. Eventuation as a corollary to God's planning. Let us now apply this principle of consistency to the making of plans, to the establishment of organized and structured potentials. We advance the theory that when God makes plans, there are certain repercussions that are inherent in and inseparable from the making of these plans. We repeat this proposition. When God makes plans, then all that is immediately necessary to the inception, realization, and consummation of these plans will inherently and inevitably make its appearance, happen, come to pass, come out finally, be the outcome of, take place, occur, in brief, will eventuate. If this did not happen, then God would not be making real plans. He would be making daydreams. We believe that God is perfectly conscious of the subjunctive, but we also believe that he thinks and plans in the indicative. In other words, he's talking for real, not just talking for maybe. When God conceives of the master universe, this conception becomes a potential, a plan. And inherent in the conceptualizing of this plan is the appearance, the happening of the architects of the master universe, the beings who personify God's plan for the master creation, together with their transcendental associates. You running out for it? If this is valid reasoning, then these eventuators are pre-creative in origin because they are related to and their appearance is a consequence of God's formulation of potentials. The creative level is the fourth level of the function of total deity. The potential level is an earlier level. It is the second. This line of reasoning is consistent with the statement that transcendentalers are neither creators nor creatures. page 332, paragraph 38. They never were created. They are conceptual repercussions of God's plan, and accordingly are not creators. They are not creators, and accordingly are not creatures. They are not creators because they do not create. They are inceptors, those who begin work, those who begin things, who initiate things, and as inceptors, they perform their work long before the creators appear on the space stage of action. I've taken the phrases inception, realization, and consummation right from the papers. They use those terms and certain synonyms. We believe that God directly or indirectly initiates the origin of these absentite beings, the transcendentalers and their governing core, the architects of the master universe. But God does not create these beings. In a certain sense, it would appear that he thinks out their existence as a natural and necessary part of the making of plans and the formulating of structured potentials, potentials that are going to emerge as actuals in the eventual appearance of the master creation. What might be the mechanics of eventuation? Again, we must depend on speculative logic. When God is making plans, he is thinking. He may be planning future events in time and space, but he is thinking far above this finite level. He is probably thinking above the absentite level, the level of transcended time and space. We believe that he is thinking in eternity. God's plans might accordingly repercuss via the Paradise Trinity in the Deity Absolute. The Deity Absolute might react to such plans by precipitating out of the potentials of infinity those factors, forces, entities, and beings that are indispensable to the inception, the starting of the plans in question. In other words, beings might eventuate out of the Deity Absolute, directly or indirectly, as a consequence, direct or indirect, of the devising of plans on God's part. At this point in our attempt at speculative logic, it is reassuring to recall the statement in the papers that the Deity Absolute may have been concerned in the origin of the Transcendentalers, page 350, paragraph 7. And we do know that the Deity Absolute has made response to the creative intent, to the culminating action of experiential deity, page 1283, paragraph 1. This is the origin of Majestan, chief of reflectivity, page 199, paragraph 7. If the Deity Absolute can thus respond to the consummational acts of experiential deity, it is not unreasonable to believe that this Absolute can also make response to the inceptive, causative intent to the plans of existential deity. And finally, this entire line of reasoning is consistent with the statement that the Transcendentalers, quote, are the eventuated children of divinity, ultimacy, and eternity, page 332, paragraph 38. Their origin arises in the plans of divinity. Their nature and function is on the ultimate level of reality. They make their appearance as an eternity event. To summarize our findings, God creates both creatures and creators. God thinks out the existence of eventuators, the transcendentalists, as a part of his thinking when he makes plans for the master universe. That's an example of pretty good slides out of the appendices. This is speculation concerning what does the word eventuate mean.
Can the corporation think out a plan in the eventuality?
Oh, I think so, yeah. The Trinity, right? You see, you notice I hedge in here. They're a result. They're caused by God directly or indirectly.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know what the linkage is here. I know I don't know. But I'm positive it comes back to God. There may be one link. There may be seven links. But I'm sure that the push button's on his desk. Now, how many people carry the message in between? I don't know. It's not too important. Well, I don't know that we've defined eventuate, but we sure have got better, more unified ignorance about the subject. At least, anyway, it isn't just a little old paragraph that everybody's beating me on the head over.
Very neat.
You see, I think this, when God plans, these plans are for real. And I view these architects as living blueprints. Now, what does an engineer do? When he dreams up a mechanical device, he doesn't just sit there with his feet up on the windowsill looking out into space. He gets down on the drafting board and draws some blueprints, doesn't he? When God does something like this, the blueprints are alive, intelligent. They're living blueprints. I think that the architects are, to God's plans, what blueprints are to an architect's or an engineer's plan. He is planning for real. He's not just dreaming about a gadget or a gizmo. He's going to build this thing. And here's what it's going to look like on paper. The architects of the Master Universe are what the Master Universe would look like on paper. Well, you can feel better about it, ain't
you?
Several buckets.
Not enough. Several buckets. I didn't say you caught the pig.
Well, I don't think we caught the pig. I think we might have scared hell out of him. Twice.
It's
right.
I think he was
sick. I wonder what Jason looks like, huh?
Well, we'll have seen him before, so that's time good. We'll be hobnobbing. We'll get invited by an absentiter. Then we'll go with one of the directors of conduct and say, my God, which fork do I use? I've never been to an absentite before. Of course,
well,
this is a
obvious street. When God formulates his plan, they're so perfect and reasoning and inception that he thinks such thing as trial and error.
That's right. That's right. I got into a line of reasoning here in writing this inception, realization, and consummation. This section was about twice as long as it is here. I chopped it off because I was getting into something that doesn't have anything to do with eventuation. This is what got me thinking about expanding the 15th appendix, which was fairly short up until then. But there are three concepts. These architects and their transcendental associates inset, which means they get things ready for Creator. An inceptor is a beginner, a setter-upper. And to put it in real simple language, an inceptor is the guy that opens up the real estate subdivision. He puts in the streets and the sewers and the lights. The Creators are contractors who come in and build a house, the many mansions, if you please. These architects, I got a clue. I picked up, I think, everything in the papers. First of all, it's the architect who designed physical matter as we know it. It says no on this side of a being who had well-nigh infinite wisdom could have produced units of matter that on the one hand are so stable and on the other hand so elastic. I couldn't find that in the papers. Old Bud came through Chicago and called me from O'Hare Field. I said, Bud, where the hell is that? He said, I'll look. A week later, called me up from O'Hare Field. He says, look in energy, mind, and matter in such and such a section. And I've been looking in energy, mind, and matter, but I started just after that section every time. Number two, there's a very interesting statement which says that the range of choice for both creators and creatures in the present universe age is strictly in accordance with the plans of the architects of the master universe. They've put a frame up, and even Mike Gill doesn't choose outside of that frame. Pretty big frame, I think. I got to thinking about that, and I thought, now how the heck can we understand that? And then I thought of another thing in the paper. It says, you know, when they're talking about Lanonadec's son, that we've had more trouble in our local universe than almost any other. And then they go on and say, this is because Mike Hill created him this way, and that's his prerogative. He has perfect right to give them an increased range of personal choice. And of course the theory is that in the long run, when you get settled in light and life, you cash in on the greater versatility of these beings. So Mike Hill himself can set up the range of choice from a local universe framework within the larger frame which has been laid out for the architects of the master universe. And then I thought of one more statement that just tickled me. Turn to page 396. And take a good hard look at the second sentence at the top of that page. Here's what it says. Life is constructed according to plans formulated by the unrevealed architects of being. You'll note that word architects of being is capitalized. I think they're transcendentalists. I think, again, why did they use the word architects there? They had a reason for picking that word. They could have called them anything. They could call them designers of being. They used the word architects, I think, because they're not going to tell us anything about them. They're not mentioned anywhere else in the papers, to my knowledge. And they didn't want to completely bug us. So they use the word architects, so we would associate them with the architects of the master universe. And these folks, I think, are another group of transcendentalists working under the architects of the master universe.